How do you change the past? Joe asked her.
I think about it. One specific aspect of it, such as one incident, or something somebody said, or a little thing that happened that I wish hadn't happened. The first time I did this, as a child,
when she was 6 years old, Gigi broke in, living in Detroit, with her parents, of course, she broke a ceramic antique statue that her father treasured.
Didn't your father foresee it? Joe asked her, with his precog ability.
He foresaw it, Pat answered, and he punished me the week before I broke the statue. But he said it was inevitable. You know the precog talent, they can foresee, but they can't change anything. Then, after the statue did break, after I broke it, I should say, I brooded about it, and I thought about that week before it broke, when I didn't get any dessert at dinner and had to go to bed at 5 p.m. I thought, Christ, or whatever a kid says, isn't there some way these unfortunate events can be averted? My father's precog ability didn't seem very spectacular to me since he couldn't alter events. I still feel that way, a sort of contempt. I spent a month trying to will the damn statue back into one piece. In my mind, I kept going back to before I broke it, imagining what it had looked like, which was awful. And then, one morning when I got up, I even dreamed about it at night. There it stood, as it used to be.
Tensely, she leaned toward Joe Chip. She spoke in a sharp, determined voice.
But neither of my parents noticed anything. It seemed perfectly normal to them that the statue was in one piece. They thought it had always been in one piece. I was the only one who remembered.
She smiled, leaned back, took another of his cigarettes from the pack, and lit up.
I'll go get my test equipment from the car, Joe said, starting toward the door.
5 cents, please,
the door said as he seized its knob.
Pay the door,
Joe said to Gigi Ashwood. When he had lugged his armload of testing apparatus from the car to his apt, he told the firm's scout to hit the road.
What?
Gigi said, astounded.
But I found her! The bounty's mine! I spent almost 10 days tracing the field to her!
Joe said to him,
I can't test her with your field present, as you well know. Talent and anti-talent fields deform each other. If they didn't, we wouldn't be in this line of business.
He held out his hand as Gigi got grumpily to his feet.
And leave me a couple of nickels, so she and I can get out of here.
I have change,
Pat murmured,
in my purse.
You can measure the force she creates, Gigi said, by the loss within my field. I've seen you do it that way 100 times,
Joe said, briefly.
This is different.
I don't have any more nickels,
Gigi said.
I can't get out.
Glancing at Joe, then at Gigi, Pat said,
Have one of mine.
She tossed Gigi a coin, which he caught, an expression of bewilderment on his face. The bewilderment, then, by degrees, changed to a grieved sullenness.
You sure shot me down,
he said as he deposited the nickel in the door's slot.
Both of you,
he muttered as the door closed after him.
I discovered her! This is really a cutthroat business when...
His voice faded out as the door clamped shut. There was, then, silence. Presently, Pat said,
When his enthusiasm goes, there isn't much left of him.
He's okay,
Joe said. He felt a usual feeling. Guilt. But not very much.
Anyhow, he did his part. Now...
Now it's your turn,
Pat said.
So to speak. May I take off my boots?
Sure,
he said. He began to set up his test equipment, checking the drums, the power supply. He started trial motions of each needle, releasing specific surges and recording their effect.
A shower?
She asked as she set her boots neatly out of the way.
A quarter, he murmured. It costs a quarter.
He glanced up at her and saw that she had begun unbuttoning her blouse.
I don't have a quarter, he said.
At the kibbutz, Pat said, everything is free.
Free? He stared at her.
That's not economically feasible. How can it operate on that basis for more than a month?
She continued unperturbedly unbuttoning her blouse.
Our salaries are paid in and we're credited with having done our job. The aggregate of our earnings underwrites the kibbutz as a whole. Actually, the Topeka kibbutz has shown a profit for several years. We, as a group, are putting in more than we're taking out.
Having unbuttoned her blouse, she laid it over the back of her chair. Under the blue, coarse blouse, she wore nothing, and he perceived her breasts, hard and high, held well by the accurate muscles of her shoulders.
"Are you sure you want to do that?" he said. "To take off your clothes, I mean?"
Pat said.
"You don't remember."
"Remember what?"
"My not taking off my clothes. In another present, you didn't like that very well, so I eradicated that, hence this."
She stood up lively.
"What did I do?"
he asked cautiously.
"When you didn't take off your clothes, refused to test you?"
"You mumbled something about Mr. Ashwood having overrated my anti-talent."
Joe said,
"I don't work that way. I don't do that."
"Here."
Bending, her breasts wagging forward, she rummaged in the pocket of her blouse, brought forth a folded sheet of paper which she handed him.
"From the previous present, the one I abolished."
He read it. Read his one-line evaluation at the end.
"Anti-psi field generated inadequate. Below standard throughout, no value against precog ratings now in existence."
And then the code mark which he employed, a circle with a stroke dividing it. "Do not hire," the symbol meant. And only he and Glenn Runciter knew that. Not even their scouts knew the meaning of the symbol, so Ashwood could not have told her. Silently, he returned the paper to her. She refolded it and returned it to her blouse pocket.
"Do you need to test me?"
she asked.
"After seeing that?"
"I have a regular procedure," Joe said. "Six indices which..."
Pat said,
"You're a little debt-stricken, ineffective bureaucrat who can't even scrape together enough coins to pay his door to let him out of his apt."
Her tone, neutral but devastating, rebounded in his ears. He felt himself stiffen, wince, and violently flush.
"This is a bad spot right now," he said. "I'll be back on my feet financially any day now. I can get a loan from the firm if necessary."
He rose unsteadily, got two cups and two saucers, poured coffee from the coffee pot.
"Sugar?"
he said. "Cream?"
"Cream,"
Pat said, still standing barefoot without her blouse. He fumbled for the door handle of the refrigerator to get out a carton of milk.
10 cents, please,"
the refrigerator said.
5 cents for opening my door. 5 cents for the cream."
"It isn't cream," he said. "It's plain milk."
He continued to pluck, futilely, at the refrigerator door.
"Just this one time," he said to it. "I swear to God I'll pay you back, tonight."
"Here,"
Pat said. She slid a dime across the table toward him.
"She should have money,"
she said as she watched him put the dime in the slot of the refrigerator.
"Your mistress. You really have failed, haven't you? I knew it when Mr. Ashwood..."
"It isn't," he grated. "Always like this."
"Do you want me to bail you out of your problems, Mr. Chip?"
Hands in the pockets of her jeans, she regarded him expressionlessly, no emotion clouding her face, only alertness.
"You know I can. Sit down and write out your evaluation report on me. Forget the tests. My talent is unique anyway. You can't measure the field I produce. It's in the past, and you're testing me in the present, which simply takes place as an automatic consequence. Do you agree?"
He said,
"Let me see that evaluation sheet you have in your blouse. I want to look at it one more time, before I decide."
From her blouse, she once more brought forth the folded-up yellow sheet of paper. She calmly passed it across the table to him, and he reread it.
"My writing," he said to himself. "Yes, it's true."
He returned it to her, and from the collection of testing items took a fresh, clean sheet of the same familiar yellow paper. On it he wrote her name, then spurious, extraordinarily high test results, and then at last his conclusions, his new conclusions.
"Has unbelievable power, anti-psi field unique in scope, can probably negate any assembly of precogs imaginable."
After that he scratched a symbol, this time two crosses, both underlined. Pat, standing behind him, watched him write. He felt her breath on his neck.
What do the two underlined crosses mean?
She asked. Hire her, Joe said, at whatever cost required.
Thank you.
She dug into her purse, brought out a handful of PosCred bills, selected one, and presented it to him. A big one.
This will help you with expenses. I couldn't give it to you earlier, before you made your official evaluation of me. You would have canceled very nearly everything, and you would have gone to your grave thinking I had bribed you. Ultimately, you would have even decided that I had no counter-talent.
She then unzipped her jeans and resumed her quick, furtive undressing. Joe Chip examined what he had written, not watching her. The underlined crosses did not symbolize what he had told her. They meant, watch this person. She is a hazard to the firm. She is dangerous. He signed the test paper, folded it, and passed it to her. She at once put it away in her purse.
When can I move my things in here?
She asked as she padded toward the bathroom.
I consider it mine as of now, since I've already paid you what must be virtually the entire month's rent.
Anytime, he said. The bathroom said, 50 cents,
please, before turning on the water.
Pat padded back into the kitchen to reach into her purse. 4. Wild new Ubix salad dressing. Not Italian, not French, but an entirely new and different taste treat that's waking up the world. Wake up to Ubix and be wild. Safe, when taken as directed. Back in New York once more, his trip to the beloved Brethren Moratorium completed, Glenn Runciter landed via a silent and impressive all-electric hired limousine on the roof of the central installation of Runciter Associates. A descent chute dropped him speedily to his fifth-floor office. Presently, at 9:30 a.m. local time, he sat in the massive, old-fashioned, authentic walnut-and-leather swivel chair behind his desk, talking on the vidphone to his public relations department.
Tamish, I just now got back from Zurich. I conferred with Ella there.
Runciter glared at his secretary, who had cautiously entered his personal, oversized office, shutting the door behind her.
What do you want, Mrs. Frick?
He asked her. Withered, timorous Mrs. Frick, her face dabbed with spots of artificial color to compensate for her general ancient grayness, made a gesture of disavowal. She had no choice but to bother him.
Okay, Mrs. Frick, he said patiently. What is it?
A new client, Mr. Runciter. I think you should see her.
She both advanced toward him and retreated, a difficult maneuver which Mrs. Frick alone could carry off. It had taken her 10 decades of practice.
As soon as I'm off the phone,
Runciter told her. Into the phone, he said,
How often do our ads run on primetime TV planet-wide? Still once every 3rd hour?
Not quite that, Mr. Runciter. Over the course of a full day, Prudence ads appear on an average of once every 3rd hour per UHF channel. But the cost of primetime...
I want them to appear every hour,
Runciter said.
Ella thinks that would be better.
On the trip back to the Western Hemisphere, he had decided which of their ads he liked the most.
You know that recent Supreme Court ruling where a husband can legally murder his wife if he can prove she wouldn't under any circumstances give him a divorce?
Yes, the so-called.
I don't care what it's called. What matters is that we have a TV ad made up on that already. How does that ad go? I've been trying to remember it.
Tamish said,
There's this man, an ex-husband, being tried. First comes a shot of the jury, then the judge, then a pan up on the prosecuting attorney, cross-examining the ex-husband. He says, It would seem, sir, that your wife...
That's right,
Runciter said with satisfaction. He had originally helped write the ad. It was, in his opinion, another manifestation of the marvelous multifacetedness of his mind.
Is it not the assumption, however, Tamish said, that the missing sighs are at work, as a group, for one of the larger investment houses? Seeing as how this is probably so, perhaps we should stress one of our business establishment commercials. Do you perhaps recall this one, Mr. Runciter? You chose a husband home from his job at the end of the day. He still has on his electric yellow cummerbund, petal skirt, knee-hugging hose, and military-style visored cap. He seats himself wearily on the living room couch, starts to take off one of his gauntlets, then hunches over, frowns, and says, "Gosh, Jill, I wish I knew what's been wrong with me lately." Sometimes, with greater frequency, almost every day, the least little remark at my office makes me think that, well, somebody's reading my mind. Then she says, "If you're worried about that, why don't we contact our nearest prudence organization? They'll lease us an inertial at prices easy on our budget, and then you'll feel like your old self again." Then this great smile appears on his face, and he says, "Why, this nagging feeling is already..."
Again appearing in the doorway to Runciter's office, Mrs. Frick said,
"Please, Mr. Runciter."
Her glasses quivered. He nodded.
"I'll talk to you later, Tamish. Anyhow, get hold of the networks and start our material on the hour basis as I outlined."
He rang off, then regarded Mrs. Frick silently.
"I went all the way to Switzerland," he said presently, "and had Ella roused to get that information, that advice."
"Mr. Runciter is free, Miss Wirt."
His secretary tottered to one side, and a plump woman rolled into the office. Her head, like a basketball, bobbled up and down. Her great round body propelled itself toward a chair, and there, at once, she seated herself, narrow legs dangling. She wore an unfashionable spider-silk coat, looking like some amiable bug wound up in a cocoon not spun by itself. She looked encased. However, she smiled. She seemed fully at ease. In her late 40s, Runciter decided, past any period in which she might have had a good figure.
"Ah, Miss Wirt," he said. "I can't give you too much time. Maybe you should get to the point. What's the problem?"
In a mellow, merry, incongruous voice, Miss Wirt said,
"We're having a little trouble with telepaths. We think so, but we're not sure. We maintain a telepath of our own, one we know about and who's supposed to circulate among our employees. If he comes across any size, telepaths or precogs, any kind, he's supposed to report to..."
She eyed Runciter brightly.
"To my principal. Late last week he made such a report. We have an evaluation, done by a private firm, on the capacities of the various prudence agencies. Yours is rated foremost."
"I know that,"
Runciter said. He had seen the evaluation, as a matter of fact. As yet, however, it had brought him little, if any, greater business. But now this.
"How many telepaths," he said, "did your man pick up? More than one?"
"Two, at least."
"Possibly more?"
"Possibly."
Miss Wirt nodded.
"Here's how we operate," Runciter said. "First, we measure the psi field objectively, so we can tell what we're dealing with. That generally takes from 1 week to 10 days, depending on..."
Miss Wirt interrupted.
"My employer wants you to move in your inertials right away, without the time-consuming and expensive formality of making tests."
"We wouldn't know how many inertials to bring in, or what kind, or where to station them. Diffusing a psi operation has to be done on a systematic basis. We can't wave a magic wand or spray toxic fumes into corners. We have to balance Hollis's people individual by individual, an anti-talent for every talent. If Hollis has gotten into your operation, he's done it the same way, psi by psi. One gets into the personnel department, hires another, that person sets up a department or takes charge of a department and requisitions a couple more. Sometimes it takes them months. We can't undo in 24 hours what they've constructed over a long period of time. Big-time psi activity is like a mosaic. They can't afford to be impatient, and neither can we."
"My employer,"
Miss Wirt said cheerfully,
is impatient.
I'll talk to him. Runciter reached for the vidphone. Who is he and what's his number?
You'll deal through me.
Maybe I won't deal at all. Why won't you tell me who you represent?
He pressed a covert button mounted under the rim of his desk. It would bring his resident telepath, Nina Freed, into the next office, where she could monitor Miss Wirt's thought processes.
I can't work with these people, he said to himself, if I don't know who they are. For all I know, Ray Hollis is trying to hire me.
You're hidebound,
Miss Wirt said.
All we're asking for is speed, and we're only asking for that because we have to have it. I can tell you this much. Our operation, which they've infested, isn't on Earth. From the standpoint of potential yield, as well as from an investment standpoint, it's our primary project. My principal has put all his negotiable assets into it. Nobody's supposed to know about it. The greatest shock to us in finding telepaths on the site...
Excuse me, Runciter said.
He rose, walked to the office door.
I'll find out how many people we have about the place who are available for use in this connection.
Shutting his office door behind him, he looked into each of the adjoining offices until he spied Nina Freed. She sat alone in a minor side room, smoking a cigarette and concentrating.
Find out who she represents, he said to her, and then find out how high they'll go. We've got 38 idle inertials,
he reflected.
Maybe we can dump all of them, or most of them, into this. I may finally have found where Hollis's smart-ass talents have sneaked off to. The whole goddamn bunch of them.
He returned to his own office, reseated himself behind his desk.
If telepaths have gotten into your operation,
he said to Miss Wirt, his hands folded before him,
then you have to face up to and accept the realization that the operation, per se, is no longer secret, independent of any specific technical info they've picked up. So why not tell me what the project is?
Hesitating, Miss Wirt said,
I don't know what the project is.
Or where it is?
No.
She shook her head.
Runciter said, do you know who your employer is?
I work for a subsidiary firm which he financially controls. I know who my immediate employer is. That's a Mr. Shepherd Howard. But I've never been told whom Mr. Howard represents.
If we supply you with the inertials you need, will we know where they're being sent?
Probably not.
Suppose we never get them back?
Why wouldn't you get them back? After they've decontaminated our operation.
Hollis's men, Runciter said, have been known to kill inertials sent out to negate them. It's my responsibility to see that my people are protected. I can't do that if I don't know where they are.
The concealed microspeaker in his left ear buzzed, and he heard the faint, measured voice of Nina Freed, audible to him alone.
Miss Wirt represents Stanton Mick. She is his confidential assistant. There is no one named Shepherd Howard. The project under discussion exists primarily on Luna. It has to do with TechPrize, Mick's research facilities, the controlling stock of which Miss Wirt keeps in her name. She does not know any technical details. No scientific evaluations or memos or progress reports are ever made available to her by Mr. Mick, and she resents this enormously. From Mick's staff, however, she has picked up a general idea of the nature of the project. Assuming that her second-hand knowledge is accurate, the lunar project involves a radical, new, low-cost interstellar drive system approaching the velocity of light, which could be leased to every moderately affluent political or ethnological group. Mick's idea seems to be that the drive system will make colonization feasible on a mass, basic understructure, and hence no longer a monopoly of specific governments.
Nina Freed clicked off, and Runciter leaned back in his leather and walnut swivel chair to ponder.
What are you thinking?
Miss Wirt asked brightly.
I'm wondering, Runciter said, if you can afford our services. Since I have no test data to go on, I can only estimate how many inertials you'll need. But it may run as high as 40.
He said this knowing that Stanton Mick could afford, or could figure out how to get someone else to underwrite, an unlimited number of inertials.
40,
Miss Wirt echoed.
That is quite a few.
The more we make use of, the sooner we can get the job done. Since you're in a hurry, we'll move them all in at one time. If you're authorized to sign a work contract in the name of your employer...
He pointed a steady, unyielding finger at her. She did not blink.
And you can come up with a retainer now. We could probably accomplish this within 72 hours.
He eyed her then, waiting. The micro-speaker in his ear rasped,
As owner of Tech Prize, she is fully bonded. She can legally obligate her firm up to and including its total worth. Right now, she's calculating how much this would be if converted on today's market. A pause. Several billion poscreds, she has decided, but she doesn't want to do this. She doesn't like the idea of committing herself to both a contract and retainer. She would prefer to have Mick's attorneys do that, even if it means several days' delay.
But they're in a hurry,
Brunsiter reflected.
Or so they say.
The micro-speaker said,
She has an intuition that you know or have guessed whom she represents, and she's afraid you'll up your fee accordingly. Mick knows his reputation. He considers himself the world's greatest mark, so he negotiates in this manner. Through someone or some firm as a front. On the other hand, they want as many inertials as they can get, and they're resigned to that being enormously expensive.
40 inertials,
Brunsiter said idly. He scratched with his pen at a small sheet of blank paper on his desk for just such purposes.
Let's see, 6 times 50 times 3 times 40...
Miss Wirt, still smiling her glazed, happy smile, waited with visible tension.
I wonder, he murmured, who paid Hollis to put his employees in the middle of your project?
That doesn't really matter, does it?
Miss Wirt said.
What matters is that they're there.
Runciter said,
Sometimes one never finds out. But, as you say, it's the same as when ants find their way into your kitchen. You don't ask why they're there, you just begin the job of getting them back out.
He had arrived at a cost figure. It was enormous.
I'll have to think it over,
Miss Wirt said. She raised her eyes from the shocking sight of his estimate and half rose to her feet.
Is there somewhere, an office, where I can be alone, and possibly phone Mr. Howard?
Runciter, also rising, said,
It's rare for any prudence organization to have that many inertials available at one time. If you wait, the situation will change. So if you want them, you'd better act.
And you think it would really take that many inertials?
Taking Miss Wirt by the arm, he led her from his office and down the hall, to the firm's map room.
This shows, he told her, the location of our inertials, plus the inertials of other prudence organizations. In addition to that, it shows, or tries to show, the location of all of Hollis's psis.
He systematically counted the psi ident flags, which, one by one, had been removed from the map. He wound up holding the final one, that of S. Dole Melipone.
I know now where they are,
he said to Miss Wirt, who had lost her mechanical smile as she comprehended the significance of the unpositioned ident flags. Taking hold of her damp hand, he deposited Melipone's flag among her damp fingers and closed them around it.
You can stay here and meditate, he said. There's a vidphone over there,
he pointed.
No one'll bother you. I'll be in my office.
He left the map room, thinking,
I really don't know that this is where they are, all those missing psis, but it's possible.
And, Stanton Mick had waived the routine procedure of making an objective test. Therefore, if he wound up hiring inertials which he did not need, it would be his own fault. Legalistically speaking, Runciter Associates was required to notify the society that some of the missing size, if not all, had been found. But he had 5 days in which to file the notification, and he decided to wait until the last day.
"This kind of business opportunity," he reflected, "happens once in a lifetime." "Mrs. Frick," he said, entering her outer office, "type up a work contract specifying 40...
He broke off. Across the room sat two persons. The man, Joe Chip, looked haggard and hungover and more than usually glum. Looked, in fact, about as always, the glumness accepted. But beside him lounged a long-legged girl with brilliant, tumbling black hair and eyes. Her intense, distilled beauty illuminated that part of the room, igniting it with heavy, sullen fire. It was, he thought, as if the girl resisted being attractive, disliked the smoothness of her skin, and the sensual, swollen, dark quality of her lips.
"She looks," he thought, "as if she just now got out of bed, still disordered, resentful of the day, in fact of every day."
Walking over to the two of them, Runciter said,
"I gather Gigi is back from Topeka?"
"This is Pat,"
Joe Chip said. No last name. He indicated Runciter, then sighed. He had a peculiar defeated quality hanging over him, and yet, underneath, he did not seem to have given up. A vague and ragged hint of vitality lurked behind the resignation. It seemed to Runciter that Joe most nearly could be accused of feigning spiritual downfall. The real article, however, was not there.
"Anti-what?"
Runciter asked the girl, who still sat sprawling in her chair, legs extended. The girl murmured,
"Anti-ketogenesis."
"What's that mean?"
"The prevention of ketosis,"
the girl said remotely.
"As by the administration of glucose."
To Joe, Runciter said,
"Explain."
"Give Mr. Runciter your test sheet,"
Joe said to the girl. Sitting up, the girl reached for her purse, rummaged, then produced one of Joe's wrinkled yellow score sheets, which she unfolded, glanced at, and passed to Runciter.
"Amazing score,"
Runciter said.
"Is she really this good?"
he asked Joe. And then he saw the two underlined crosses, the graphic symbol of indictment, of, in fact, treachery.
"She's the best so far," Joe said.
"Come into my office,"
Runciter said to the girl. He led the way, and behind them the two of them followed. Fat Miss Wirt, all at once, breathless, her eyes rolling, appeared.
"I phoned Mr. Howard,"
she informed Runciter.
"He has now given me my instructions."
She thereupon perceived Joe Chip and the girl named Pat. For an instant, she hesitated, then plunged on.
"Mr. Howard would like the formal arrangements made right away, so we may go ahead now. I've already acquainted you with the urgency and the time factor."
She smiled her glassy, determined smile.
"Do you two mind waiting?"
she asked them.
"My business with Mr. Runciter is of a priority nature."
Glancing at her, Pat laughed, a low, throaty laugh of contempt.
"You'll have to wait, Miss Wirt,"
Runciter said. He felt afraid. He looked at Pat, then at Joe, and his fear quickened.
"Sit down, Miss Wirt,"
he said to her, and indicated one of the outer office chairs. Miss Wirt said,
"I can tell you exactly, Mr. Runciter, how many inertials we intend to take. Mr. Howard feels he can make an adequate determination of our needs, of our problem."
"How many?"
Runciter asked.
11,
Miss Wirt said.
"We'll sign the contract in a little while,"
Runciter said.
"As soon as I'm free."
With his big, wide hand, he guided Joe and the girl into his inner office. He shut the door behind them and seated himself.
"They'll never make it,"
he said to Joe.
"With 11, or 15 or 20, especially not with S. Dole Melipone involved on the other side.
He felt tired as well as afraid.
This is, as I assume, the potential trainee that Gigi scouted in Topeka, and you believe we should hire her? Both you and Gigi agree. Well, then we'll hire her, naturally. Maybe I'll turn her over to Mick, he said to himself. Make her one of the 11. Nobody has managed to tell me yet, he said, which of the Psy talents she counters.
Mrs. Frick says you flew to Zurich, Joe said. What did Ella suggest?
More ads, Runciter said. On TV, every hour.
Into his intercom, he said,
Mrs. Frick, draw up an agreement of employment between ourselves and a Jane Doe. Specify the starting salary that we and the union agreed on last December. Specify...
What is the starting salary? The girl Pat asked, her voice suffused with sardonic suspicion of a cheap, childish sort. Runciter eyed her.
I don't even know what you can do.
It's precog, Glenn, Joe Chip grated, but in a different way. He did not elaborate. He seemed to have run down, like an old-time battery-powered watch.
Is she ready to go to work? Runciter asked Joe. Or is this one we have to train and work with and wait for? We've got almost 40 idle inertials and we're hiring another. Well, 40 less, I suppose, 11. 30 idle employees, all drawing full scale while they sit around with their thumbs in their noses. I don't know, Joe. I really don't. Maybe we ought to fire our scouts. Anyway, I think I found the rest of Hollis's size. I'll tell you about it later.
Into his intercom, he said,
specify that we can discharge this Jane Doe without notice, without severance pay or compensation of any kind. Nor is she eligible for the first 90 days for pension, health, or sick pay benefits.
To Pat, he said,
starting salary in all cases begins at 400 creds per month, figuring on 20 hours a week. And you'll have to join a union. The Mine, Mill, and Smelter Workers Union. They're the one that signed up all the Prudence Organization employees 3 years ago. I have no control over that.
I get more, Pat said, maintaining vidphone relays at the Topeka Kibitz. Your scout, Mr. Ashwood, said...
Our scouts lie, Runciter said. And, in addition, we're not legally bound by anything they say. No Prudence Organization is.
The office door opened, and Mrs. Frick crept unsteadily in with the typed-out agreement.
Thank you, Mrs. Frick,
Runciter said, accepting the papers.
I have a 20-year-old wife in Cold Pack, he said to Joe and Pat. A beautiful woman who, when she talks to me, gets pushed out of the way by some weird kid named Jory. And then I'm talking to him, not her. Ella frozen in half-life and dimming out. And that battered crone for my secretary that I have to look at all day long.
He gazed at the girl Pat, with her black, strong hair and her sensual mouth. In him he felt unhappy cravings arise, cloudy and pointless wants that led nowhere, that returned to him empty, as in the completion of a geometrically perfect circle.
I'll sign, Pat said,
and reached for the desk pen. 5.
Can't make the frug contest, Helen?
Stomach's upset.
I'll fix you, Ubik. Ubik drops you back in the thick of things fast.
Taken as directed, Ubik speeds relief to head and stomach.
Remember, Ubik is only seconds away.
Avoid prolonged use.
During the long days of forced, unnatural idleness, the anti-telepath Tippy Jackson slept regularly until noon. An electrode planted within her brain perpetually stimulated EREM, extremely rapid eye movement sleep. So while tucked within the percale sheets of her bed, she had plenty to do. At this particular moment, her artificially induced dream state centered around a mythical Hollis functionary endowed with enormous psionic powers. Every other inertial in the soul system had either given up or been melted down into lard. By process of elimination, the task of nullifying the field generated by this supernatural entity had devolved to her.
"I can't be myself while you're around,"
her nebulous opponent informed her. On his face, a feral, hateful expression formed, giving him the appearance of a psychotic squirrel. In her dream, Tippy answered,
"Perhaps your definition of your self-system lacks authentic boundaries. You've erected a precarious structure of personality on unconscious factors over which you have no control. That's why you feel threatened by me."
"Aren't you an employee of a prudence organization?"
the Hollis telepath demanded, looking nervously about.
"If you're the stupendous talent you claim to be," Tippy said, "you can tell that by reading my mind."
"I can't read anybody's mind," the telepath said. "My talent is gone. I'll let you talk to my brother Bill. Here, Bill, talk to this lady. Do you like this lady?"
Bill, looking more or less like his brother, the telepath, said,
"I like her fine because I'm a precog and she doesn't postscript me."
He shuffled his feet and grinned, revealing great, pale teeth, as blunt as shovels.
"I, that am curtailed of this fair proportion, cheated of feature by dissembling nature."
He paused, wrinkling his forehead.
"How does it go, Matt?"
he asked his brother.
"Deformed, unfinished, sent before my time into this breathing world, scarce half made up,"
Matt, the squirrel-like telepath, said, scratching meditatively at his pelt.
"Oh, yeah,"
Bill, the precog, nodded.
"I remember. And that's so lamely and unfashionable that dogs bark at me as I halt by them. From Richard III?
He explained to Tippy. Both brothers grinned. Even their incisors were blunt, as if they lived on a diet of uncooked seeds. Tippy said,
"What does that mean?"
"It means,"
both Matt and Bill said in unison,
"that we're gonna get you."
The vidphone rang, waking Tippy up. Stumbling groggily to it, confounded by floating colored bubbles blinking, she lifted the receiver and said,
"Oh, God, it's late,"
she thought, seeing the clock.
"I'm turning into a vegetable."
Glenn Runciter's face emerged on the screen.
"Hello, Mr. Runciter,"
she said, standing out of sight of the phone scanner.
"Has a job turned up for me?"
"Ah, Mrs. Jackson," Runciter said. "I'm glad I caught you. A group is forming under Joe Chips in my direction. 11 in all. A major work assignment for those we choose. We've been examining everyone's history. Joe thinks yours looks good, and I tend to agree. How long will it take you to get down here?"
His tone seemed adequately optimistic, but on the little screen, his face looked hard-pressed and careworn. Tippy said,
"For this one, will I be living—"
"Yes, you'll have to pack." Chidingly, he said, "We're supposed to be packed and ready to go at all times. That's a rule I don't ever want broken, especially in a case like this where there's a time factor."
"I am packed. I'll be at the New York office in 15 minutes. All I have to do is leave a note for my husband, who's at work."
"Well, okay,"
Runciter said, looking preoccupied. He was probably already reading the next name on his list.
"Goodbye, Mrs. Jackson,"
he rang off.
That was a strange dream,
she thought as she hastily unbuttoned her pajamas and hurried back into the bedroom for her clothes.
What did Bill and Matt say that poetry was from? Richard III,
she remembered, seeing in her mind once more their flat, big teeth, their unformed, knob-like, identical heads, with tufts of reddish hair growing from them like patches of weeds.
"I don't think I've ever read Richard III, she realized. "Or if I did, it must have been years ago when I was a child." "How can you dream lines of poetry you don't know?" she asked herself. "Maybe an actual non-dream telepath was getting at me while I slept, or a telepath and a precog working together, the way I saw them in my dream. It might be a good idea to ask our research department whether Hollis does, by any remote chance, employ a brother team named Matt and Bill."
Puzzled and uneasy, she began as quickly as possible to dress. Lighting a green All Havana Cuesta Rey Palma Supreme, Glenn Runciter leaned back in his noble chair, pressed a button of his intercom, and said,
"Make out a bounty check, Mrs. Frick, payable to G.G. Ashwood for 100 pos creds."
"Yes, Mr. Runciter."
He watched G.G. Ashwood, who paced with manic restlessness about the big office with its genuine hardwood floor, against which G.G.'s feet clacked irritatingly.
"Joe Chip can't seem to tell me what she does," Runciter said.
"Joe Chip is a grunk," G.G. said.
"How come she, this Pat, can travel back into time and no one else can? I'll bet this talent isn't new. You scouts probably just missed noticing it up until now. Anyhow, it's not logical for a prudence organization to hire her. It's a talent, not an anti-talent. We deal in..."
"As I explained, and as Joe indicated on the test report, it aborts the precogs out of business."
"But that's only a side effect," Runciter pondered moodily. "Joe thinks she's dangerous. I don't know why."
"Did you ask him why?"
Runciter said,
"He mumbled, the way he always does. Joe never has reasons, just hunches. On the other hand, he wants to include her in the Mick operation."
He shuffled through, rooted among and rearranged the personnel department documents before him on his desk.
"Ask Joe to come in here so we can see if we've got our group of 11 set up."
He examined his watch.
"They should be arriving about now. I'm going to tell Joe to his face that he's crazy to include this Pat Conley girl if she's so dangerous. Wouldn't you say, G.G.?"
G.G. Ashwood said,
"He's got a thing going with her."
"What sort of thing?"
"A sexual understanding."
"Joe has no sexual understanding. Nina Freed read his mind the other day, and he's too poor even to..."
He broke off because the office door had opened. Mrs. Frick teetered her way in, carrying G.G.'s bounty check for him to sign.
"I know why he wants her along on the Mick operation,"
Runciter said as he scratched his signature on the check.
"So he can keep an eye on her. He's going to. He's going to measure the psi field, despite what the client stipulated. We have to know what we're up against. Thank you, Mrs. Frick."
He waved her away and held the check out to G.G. Ashwood.
"Suppose we don't measure the psi field, and it turns out to be too intense for our inertials. Who gets blamed?"
"We do,"
G.G. said.
"I told them 11 wasn't enough. We're supplying our best. We're doing the best we can. After all, getting Stanton Mick's patronage is a matter of great importance to us. Amazing that someone as wealthy and powerful as Mick could be so short-sighted, so goddamn miserly. Mrs. Frick, is Joe out there? Joe Chip?"
Mrs. Frick said,
"Mr. Chip is in the outer office, with a number of other people."
"How many other people, Mrs. Frick? 10 or 11?
I'd say about that many, Mr. Runciter. Give or take 1 or 2?
To G.G. Ashwood, Runciter said,
"That's the group. I want to see them, all of them together, before they leave for Luna."
To Mrs. Frick, he said,
"Send them in."
He puffed vigorously on his green-wrapped cigar. She gyrated out.
"We know," Runciter said to G.G., "that as individuals they perform well. It's all down here on paper."
He rattled the documents on his desk.
"But how about together? How great a polyencephalic counterfield will they generate together? Ask yourself that, G.G. That is the question to ask."
"I guess time will tell,"
G.G. Ashwood said.
"I've been in this business a long time,"
Runciter said. From the outer office, people began to file in.
"This is my contribution to contemporary civilization."
"That puts it well,"
G.G. said.
"You're a policeman guarding human privacy."
"You know what Ray Hollis says about us?"
Runciter said.
"He says we're trying to turn the clock back."
He eyed the individuals who had begun to fill up his office. They gathered near one another, none of them speaking. They waited for him.
What an ill-assorted bunch, he thought pessimistically.
A young string bean of a girl with glasses and straight lemon-yellow hair, wearing a cowboy hat, black lace mantilla and Bermuda shorts, that would be Edie Dorn. A good-looking, older, dark woman with tricky, deranged eyes who wore a silk sari and nylon obi and bobby socks. Francie something. A part-time schizophrenic who imagined that sentient beings from Beetlejuice occasionally landed on the roof of her Connapt building. A woolly-haired adolescent boy wrapped in a superior and cynical cloud of pride. This one, in a floral muumuu and spandex bloomers, Runciter had never encountered before. And so it went. 5 females and, he counted, 5 males. Someone was missing. Ahead of Joe Chip, the smoldering, brooding girl, Patricia Conley, entered. That made the 11th. The group had all appeared.
"You made good time, Mrs. Jackson,"
he said to the mannish, 30-ish, sand-colored lady, wearing ersatz vicuna trousers and a gray sweatshirt, on which had been printed a now-faded full-face portrait of Bertrand Lord Russell.
"You had less time than anybody else, inasmuch as I notified you last."
Tippy Jackson smiled a bloodless, sand-colored smile.
"Some of you I know," Runciter
said, rising from his chair and indicating with his hands that they should find chairs and make themselves comfortable, smoking if necessary.
"You, Miss Dawn, Mr. Chip and I chose you first because of your top-notch activity vis-a-vis S. Dole Melipone, whom you eventually lost through no fault of your own."
"Thank you, Mr. Runciter,"
Edie Dorn said in a wispy, shy trickle of a voice. She blushed and stared wide-eyed at the far wall.
"It's good to be a part of this new undertaking,"
she added with undernourished conviction.
"Which one of you is Al Hammond?"
Runciter asked, consulting his documents. An excessively tall, stoop-shouldered Negro with a gentle expression on his elongated face made a motion to indicate himself.
"I've never met you before,"
Runciter said, reading the material from Al Hammond's file.
"You rate highest among our anti-precogs. I should, of course, have gotten around to meeting you. How many of the rest of you are anti-precog?"
3 additional hands appeared.
"The 4 of you," Runciter said, "will undoubtedly get a great bloop out of meeting and working with G.G. Ashwood's most recent discovery, who aborts precogs on a new basis. Perhaps Miss Conley herself will describe it to us."
He nodded toward Pat, and found himself standing before a shop window on 5th Avenue, a rare coin shop. He was studying an uncirculated U.S. gold dollar and wondering if he could afford to add it to his collection.
"What collection?"
he asked himself, startled.
"I don't collect coins. What am I doing here? How long have I been wandering around window shopping when I ought to be in my office supervising?"
He could not remember what he generally supervised, a business of some kind, dealing in people with abilities, special talents. He shut his eyes, trying to focus his mind.
"No, I had to give that up," he realized. "Because of a coronary last year, I had to retire. But I was just there,"
he remembered.
"Only a few seconds ago, in my office, talking to a group of people about a new project."
He shut his eyes.
"It's gone,"
he thought dazedly.
"Everything I built up."
When he opened his eyes, he found himself back in his office. He faced G.G. Ashwood, Joe Chip, and a dark, intensely attractive girl whose name he did not recall. Other than that, his office was empty, which, for reasons he did not understand, struck him as strange.
"Mr. Runciter," Joe Chip said, "I'd like you to meet Patricia Conley."
The girl said,
"How nice to be introduced to you at last, Mr. Runciter."
She laughed, and her eyes flashed exultantly. Runciter did not know why. Joe Chip realized,
she's been doing something.
Pat? He said aloud.
I can't put my finger on it, but things are different.
He gazed wonderingly around the office. It appeared as it had always. Too loud a carpet, too many unrelated art objects. On the walls, original pictures of no artistic merit whatever. Glenn Runciter had not changed. Shaggy and gray, his face wrinkled broodingly, he returned Joe's stare. He too seemed perplexed. Over by the window, G.G. Ashwood, wearing his customary natty birch-bark pantaloons, hemp-rope belt, peekaboo see-through top, and train engineer's tall hat, shrugged indifferently. He, obviously, saw nothing wrong.
Nothing is different,
Pat said.
Everything is different, Joe said to her.
You must have gone back into time and put us on a different track. I can't prove it, and I can't specify the nature of the changes.
No domestic quarreling on my time,
Runciter said frowningly. Joe, taken aback, said,
domestic quarreling?
He saw then, on Pat's finger, the ring, wrought silver and jade. He remembered helping her pick it out.
2 days, he thought, before we got married. That was over a year ago, despite how bad off I was financially. That, of course, has changed now. Pat, with her salary and her money-minding propensity, fixed that for all time.
Anyhow, to continue, Runciter said, we must each of us ask ourselves why Stanton Mick took his business to a prudence organization other than ours. Logically, we should have gotten the contract. We're the finest in the business, and we're located in New York, where Mick generally prefers to deal. Do you have any theory, Mrs. Chip?
He looked hopefully in Pat's direction. Pat said,
do you really want to know, Mr. Runciter?
Yes,
he nodded vigorously.
I'd very much like to know.
I did it,
Pat said.
How?
With my talent.
Runciter said,
what talent? You don't have a talent. You're Joe Chip's wife.
At the window, G.G. Ashwood said,
you came here to meet Joe and me for lunch.
She has a talent, Joe said.
He tried to remember, but already it had become foggy. The memory dimmed even as he tried to resurrect it.
A different time track, he thought. The past.
Other than that, he could not make it out. There the memory ended.
My wife, he thought, is unique. She can do something no one else on Earth can do. In that case, why isn't she working for Runciter Associates? Something is wrong.
Have you measured it?
Runciter asked him.
I mean, that's your job. You sound as if you have. You sound sure of yourself.
I'm not sure of myself, Joe said. But I am sure about my wife, he said to himself.
I'll get my test gear, he said, and we'll see what sort of a field she creates.
Oh, come on, Joe,
Runciter said angrily.
If your wife has a talent or an anti-talent, you would have measured it at least a year ago. You wouldn't be discovering it now.
He pressed a button on his desk intercom.
Personnel, do we have a file on Mrs. Chip, Patricia Chip?
After a pause, the intercom said,
no file on Mrs. Chip. Under her maiden name, perhaps?
Connolly, Joe said. Patricia Connolly.
Again, a pause.
On a Miss Patricia Connolly, we have 2 items. An initial scout report by Mr. Ashwood, and then test findings by Mr. Chip.
From the slot of the intercom, repros of the 2 documents slowly dribbled forth and dropped to the surface of the desk. Examining Joe Chip's findings, Runciter said, scowling,
Joe, you better look at this. Come here.
He jabbed a finger at the page, and Joe, coming over beside him, saw the 2 underlined crosses. He and Runciter glanced at each other, then at Pat.
I know what it reads,
Pat said levelly.
Unbelievable power. Anti-psi field unique in scope.
She concentrated, trying visibly to remember the exact wording.
Can probably...
We did get the Mick contract,
Runciter said to Joe Chip.
I had a group of 11 inertials in here, and then I suggested to her,
Joe said,
that she show the group.